more than 25 years, Andrew Kolarik has been utilizing computerized information systems with a few simple objectives: mastering the technology, helping others make the best use of their systems, and preparing organizations for the future. And as a consultant, speaker, author, inventor, and researcher, the doctor here, his goal is a simple one: to help you secure your information systems through planning, policies, and training. He's our guest this hour on Coast to Coast. Dr. Andrew, how are you?
Oh, excellent. George, how about yourself?
I'm fine. I'm glad I'm not at UCLA with all my records stashed away there. Isn't that something?
Well, but your records are in a lot of other places.
Well, that's true. What's going on? How can a hacker, first of all, Andrew, how can they break into a system? Do they have inside information, or do they just luck out? How do they get into somebody's computer system like that?
Well, you have internal people who access records and systems, sometimes authorized, sometimes not, and they work with other people who steal these records. And then you also have outside external threats from anywhere around the globe who they come in through remote connections, they break your firewalls, they bypass security protocols, they wander around, they exploit software that hasn't been updated or has serious security flaws in it, and then they just start transferring data.
I noticed that my bank about a year or so ago went to a system where not only do you use your ID and your password, then you have a picture that you have to recognize, and then you put in another code or PIN number. I mean, are these layers that they're trying to use to avert people hacking into systems?
Well, the security these days is being implemented in this kind of onion layer approach. Let's add one more layer. And the theory is the more that we subject you to interrogation of your identity, the less likely somebody is going to randomly come in and use your account. The problem with that is if you have a friend with you or you have someone monitoring your computer because you might be doing this stuff remotely.
Okay.
And your computer can be monitored. Keyboard strokes, screenshots can all be transferred electronically. You could have somebody that's actually on the inside of an organization, like a bank, who is recording this stuff because you look like a likely target. So, you know, these are only measures of security. There really aren't rock-solid design systems because we have human components.
I went and I saw the movie last week, Casino Royale, the James Bond movie. It was a great movie. And in it, they had a wire transfer of millions of dollars with a wireless system with a push of a button, and it was done. Is it that easy to transfer that kind of money, that amount of money? Because if it is, Andrew, if it's that easy, then it's probably that easy to steal it.
Well, I actually had a online account when I was living in New Zealand, and they have what's called one-off payments. I could go into my account, and I could create a one-off payment, direct it to any account I wanted, and it would be paid. And it was that quick. Now, if I wanted to dispute that transfer, I only had a few days in which to dispute it. Some banks will require you to wait 3, 5, maybe even a week to verify that this is actually going to transfer. But the fact of the matter is, that's dependent on the bank. That's policy. It's not law. And yes, it does happen that fast.
So if someone is able to tap into a bank account, they might be able to steal your money, transfer it to their own account somewhere, and you might be out of luck.
Absolutely. In fact, they can do the same thing with your credit card. A lot of credit card companies want you to now have an online access to your account.
Right.
Well, if I go online using your account, I can transfer that to some other electronic money system and then withdraw it, and the money's gone before even the credit card company does anything about it, as long as it's under that limit.
All right, Andrew, let's come up with some recommendations for us. What do we do? First of all, let's talk about the computer. What do we do to avoid this? Can we avoid it?
Well, a lot of this can be avoided, but not 100%. We have an insatiable desire to know everything about everyone and store that information. In fact, we centralize these databases now because we have security needs and we have lots of busybodies. You know, for instance, if you want to rent an apartment, think about all the information you provide your potential landlord.
It's huge.
It's huge. And is it secured? Who is getting a copy of it? When is it destroyed, if ever? Is the maintenance guy opening up the locker in the evening and selling that information, et cetera, et cetera? So we are required to provide information, and then people are accumulating it and storing it just in case they need it later. And this isn't just businesses. This is the government, education institutions, financial institutions, on and on and on. And especially now in the whole war on terror, because we need to know what plane you flew on, what seat you sat in,
yep,
and how risky are you to any potential future threat. And so this whole, again, an incestuous lust for this information is driving all these computerized databases and people running them to keep this stuff indefinitely.
Is there some kind of code on your boarding pass where they can see and flag you the minute you're trying to go through the line and they pull you out? How do they know who you are at that point?
Well, when right after 9/11, there was a small code that got added that I noticed. And because I was traveling internationally a lot at that time, and I kept getting searched. You know, if you can imagine my Google searches, because I'm a terrorism researcher, you know, how to make a sarin gas bomb.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
uh-huh.
I have to believe that they were watching me, because I'm returning from overseas to the United States,
right,
in a very turbulent time. So I took it all very, you know, with consideration and was pleasant about it. But I know that every time I flew internationally, I got flagged. Now, they changed that system after it was noted that it was too obvious. But I am certain that they have profiles. They have a system where either the check-in clerk, the person at the gate, security guards, or even prior to all that, during your e-ticket purchase, that they have a reference that you have a potential to be a problem. And it's at their discretion. They can search you at any time for any reason.
Are we too technology, is the technology so advanced now where we've just gone too far, Andrew?
I think we have exceeded our personal wisdom. We want to throw technology at what is not a technological problem. The centralization of all this information, while it seems to be wonderful, you know, I'm not the same person I was 20 years ago. I mean, I was a speed demon. I had traffic tickets all over the place. Well,
but you probably went into the old police computer and cleaned up your records.
Well, I wish I had. Let's put it that way. But, you know, that would be illegal, and I've been a good boy,
right,
at least since I've become an adult.
I'll give you that.
But the fact of the matter is, we grow, we make mistakes, but now we have a history that we can't escape. And so, the centralization, again, is one factor, but it's not just that. It's who owns this information. Now, you have a telephone, and you pay money every month for that telephone.
Yeah.
It has a telephone number. Why do you have to pay more to make it unlisted?
I know. But
that means you don't own it.
That's true. $1 or $2 a month, but you have to pay to be unlisted.
Right. That means you don't own your own phone number. So I think what we have to do is we have to reevaluate what information we actually own and put a stop to this accumulation of it. In Europe, your personal information is actually considered a property right. And in this country, we have all kinds of law on the books how to manage property disputes.
I was in St. Louis a couple of weeks ago when we got hit with a huge ice storm that knocked out power to 500,000 customers there. And one of them was a drugstore chain and in this region. And I was in there, and there was a little lady at the front of the door that had to open it by hand because the electric door didn't work. And she said, "Our computers are down and our lights are out. We're only taking cash. And if you want to come and make your purchases, please do so with cash." And I said, "Well, I got a little bit on me, so I'll go in because I'm not buying much." So I go in there, and then I see this huge line, Andrew, with people buying their goods with cash. And this poor teller with a calculator, a battery-operated one, trying to figure out the price, the tax, the Missouri tax, and then give everybody back their change from whatever they give her, whatever they had given her. And I looked at this and said, this is the future when something happens to this technology. When the ATMs go out and the computers go out, if there's some kind of electromagnetic pulse bomb that goes off, this is it. This is what's happened. We're going to be thrown back into the dark ages, and we can't handle it.
Well, I have one better for you, George.
All right.
Now, remember, you're using paper money, which really isn't money. It's currency.
Yes.
And our currency is a fraction of the printed version of all the digital currency that is in the world now. It's traded and bought and sold electronically around the world. Now, what happens when we finally lose faith in these underlying computerized systems? What happens to the ability to exchange goods and services?
They shut down.
It stops. And what are we going to do? Pull the gold fillings out of our teeth to purchase bread for the day? So, I mean, we really have now relied so heavily on all of this wonderful technology that we have gained huge amounts of efficiencies from, but we haven't decided to be prepared for the consequences, and we're not mitigating all of the other issues that come with the benefits.
Andrew, I'm going to keep you for phone calls for the next 30 minutes, okay?
Oh, absolutely.
Stay with us. If you're into computers or you're concerned about your own privacy, well, now it's your turn. Here are the phone numbers. West of the Rockies, 800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 800-825-5033. First-time caller line is 818-501-4721. And the wildcard line. My, that's ready for you, too, at 818-501-4109. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest this hour, Dr. Andrew Kolarik. We're going to take your phone calls as well as we talk about hacking, privacy. You know, the ATMs bother me too. Is there any way people are stealing money from them, Andrew?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to steal money from ATMs. You can back hack them, meaning the ATM is plugged into a network.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can access that network, then you might be able to access other systems connected to it. You can also, get a hold of somebody's card. These little wireless spy cameras can be put up on some rafter. You can watch people typing in PIN numbers. There's a whole host of things, eavesdropping, or, you know, other thieves have actually taken ATM machines and put them in locations unplugged. You put your card in, and it says, I'm sorry, the machine is down.
You mean it's not a real...
It's not a real... After you've plugged in your numbers and so
forth.
And your
PIN.
Yeah, and then they take that information that has just been card read with your PIN number.
Oh, my God.
And they go somewhere else and withdraw your money. So, again, people are very creative when it comes to money. And it's now digital.
And they just go and pick up their ATM and haul it away to a different location.
Well, yes, actually.
That is amazing. Let's take some calls. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
George?
Hi.
Yes, this is Mike from Kentucky.
Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Actually, I think I'm a victim of identity theft myself.
What happened to you?
Well, have you ever heard of card jamming in an ATM?
Andrew, have you?
Yes, to a degree.
Yes. Actually, what they do is they put some type of metal or something, I don't know what, in there to where your card will go in and you punch in your account information and what money you want to take out, and your card will not come out. But fortunately, I was able to get my card out. I took a pair of needle nose pliers that I had in my van, and the strange thing was there were these guys that were just standing there watching me the whole time.
How close were they to you?
pretty close.
They must have been the ones.
Yes, that's what I was thinking exactly, sir. And fortunately, I was able to pry it out of there. But then, just a couple weeks ago, or a couple months ago, excuse me, I'm a little nervous here. I had my wallet stolen at a wrestling match, and now I'm getting the most disgusting, I don't want to go into full detail, but the most disgusting pornography in my mailbox ever was.
All right, well, you've got a different problem from the hackers, I'm sure, but what were they trying to do, Andrew, by... You know, this metal in an ATM, were they just trying to get the number?
Well,
maybe on a sheet of, like, aluminum, and they'd see it imprinted, or what?
If you have, you know, there's a series of things that Mike may be referring to. They may be reading the magnetic strip. They may be, if it's a credit card where someone's going to take a cash withdrawal from, they may be getting the actual card numbers. Or it could even be an ATM machine scam. There's a whole series of things that could be going on here.
People are actually bold enough to do something to a bank ATM machine?
Oh, absolutely.
And hope that some police officer doesn't come by? And I guess it's always done after hours, right?
Well, sometimes it's in broad daylight. There were scams, 50 years ago where people would put a mailbox on the street corner where there wasn't one, and people would go to mail their mail. And a couple days later, they would pick up the mailbox.
And hope for checks and things
checks
like that, right?
And all kinds of things.
Unbelievable.
So, people have been creative with this stuff as long as we have been relying on other systems for our financial transactions.
So you're talking about billions of dollars being lost here.
Online and both in reality. But the real thieves are now doing it electronically. While there's some very creative people doing it in the physical world, the real money is digital.
And how much are they getting out of, let's say, an individual's bank account? A few bucks, or are they going for the big stuff?
Well, they're getting whatever they can get out of it. Let me give you an example, George.
All right.
There was approximately $1 trillion in credit card transactions in the last few years, for a one-year period.
Right.
The numbers vary depending on which source. $1 trillion. Now, if only 3 or 4% of that is criminal activity, wouldn't you say that's real money?
That's a big business.
And guess who's paying for it?
We are.
We are, through higher interest rates and credit card fees and banking fees and transfer fees and all these other things.
It's almost as if then these companies expect it and we pay for it.
Well, that's the way that they've decided they're going to mitigate that risk.
They have probably already estimated that they're going to lose X percent to thieves, and therefore we have to pay the difference.
Yes.
Amazing. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I was wondering if you believe that something is going on with your computer being hacked and you go to your local law enforcement agency and they do nothing, what kind of recourse do you have?
Well, law enforcement on a local level is not as computer savvy as we would like them to be. In fact, at the state level and federal level, they're now going through a re-education process where more and more computer savvy law enforcement are being put into the field. The fact of the matter is, unless it's life-threatening, unless you are a major corporation, they're going to go after the high-value targets because of limited manpower and resources.
I understand.
So, now that's not to say that they won't investigate it.
But it's difficult to, Andrew, isn't it?
Exactly. What will occur is, first, they will assess, do they have someone who can, you know, investigate this? Second, to what extent is it likely that they're going to be able to do something about it? And the bigger the theft, the more resources can be brought to bear to solve these crimes.
Okay, thanks, Susan. Appreciate your phone call. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. It's Richard in Las Vegas.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good.
Your editorials in After Dark are fantastic. Andrew, I have two questions. I'll say them quickly and get your answers off air. The first one is, isn't the real problem that the operating systems are made and designed so that everyone that deals with the companies that deal with the operating systems and Microsoft are allowed to get in, and isn't that a big problem? And because I found that. And secondly, isn't it possible that with computers on the stock exchange that we could get so far ahead that we could end up in a crash and not know it for a day or two? And that's not even talking about, we haven't even touched on identity theft, which is a really big problem. I'll hang up and take your answers off air. George, have a good one if I don't talk to you.
All right, thanks, Richard.
Well, to answer Richard's two questions, the first is regarding the operating system, or actually the whole user computer environment.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the designers of these systems, whether it's Microsoft or Sun or whoever, they're concerned about user features. They want you to use their system. They're in a competitive environment that says, if we don't give the user what they want, then we don't make our money. And as a result, the more user features you have, the more opportunities for security breaches and code violations. So that's a dynamic that we can't get away from until everybody demands security be built into every software and hardware product.
Can that be done?
That's market driven. And yes, it can be done to a degree. There are no perfect systems, but you can go a whole long way to eliminating most of these obvious attacks and exploits.
All right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No.
His next one was the stock exchange.
Exactly. Now, the stock exchange, again, it's a global stock exchange now because individual exchanges are trading amongst themselves globally 24/7. And a large part of it is computer transactions. And we've had Black Mondays where, you know, the stocks have dropped, you know, 500 points and so forth because the computers see a trend and start selling things off. Well, imagine, now remember, currency is also traded in these markets. Imagine that there's large breaches that occur around the world in the major currencies. And that now you lose confidence in the currency, and the valuation of all the dollars drop, and you could have a free-for-all.
And
just like that.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Patrick. I'm calling from Wichita, Kansas.
Hi, Patrick.
I was employed by Walmart, and they have a thing in Colorado called the Department of New Hires. And they were like, I don't know if it happened, but all my information, like my name, my social security number, my address, was all taken. It happened there, and it also happened at the Department of Defense. I got a letter that all my information was stolen, and my father's information, because a laptop came up missing.
Oh my God!
I just wanted to ask Andrew, what could someone? I mean, how much damage could someone do to me with that information?
Good question. Andrew?
Well, the longer it waits, the more damage they can do.
What do you mean by that, the longer it waits?
Well, there are some things you can do right now. In fact, everybody can do this. You can contact the major credit bureaus, and you can request a credit freeze, meaning no new credit may be issued without your expressed permission. Now, that's an inconvenience to them, but you can require them to do that. That's number one. Number two, any organizations that you have accounts with, banks, credit card agencies, and et cetera, you basically, when you're notified of a potential breach or loss of your data, you have to close those accounts and open new ones. Because there is a trail, depending on what database is hacked into and what data is stolen, that may allow them to exploit that information. And then the last thing is, I think, you know, there's a concept called need to know. And I think this needs to be drilled into everybody's brain now. Need to know, reassess who needs to know what about you. I don't give out any information that is relevant to reconstructing my identity without it absolutely being needed to know. And that doesn't mean some low-level bureaucrat says, you have to fill it out on the form. It means you only give them what they actually need. And then part two of that is you have to actually ask them what they do with your information before you disclose it.
Andrew, do these thieves work for a living, or is this all they do all the time? Steal?
Well, a large portion of the hackers in Russia, that's all they do, is steal money. And believe it or not, that's actually not as bad as perhaps what China's doing, which is stealing our proprietary information, our trade secrets, and then funding those industries and then kicking our butts on the world market. All of this stuff is digital now.
They probably have departments that do nothing but hack.
Yes. And in fact, if you are a first-class hacker, you're in demand. There are governments and cyber criminals out, organizations out there that would love to help you out.
I could just see new degrees now in school. Professional hacker. I got a BA in hacking or something. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George. This is Cliff from Houston.
Hey, Cliff. Thank you.
Hey, I got one question, and then I'd like to tell you a quick story. Yeah. The question is it true that they can now read your credit card information through your wallet if they're standing directly behind you, say, in line in a supermarket, or make all your credit cards void by doing something to them? That's my question, but my statement, I would love to tell you about it. It's 1971. I'm living in Brooklyn. I walk by a bank. It's about 6 o'clock at night on a Saturday night, and there was a policeman standing outside, and he was collecting the night deposit box bags with a bank official because somebody had put something in the night deposit box where it wouldn't work. next day in the newspaper, A, that was not a policeman, and B, people dropped off all their bags at night and just handed them over to these people.
Unbelievable.
That's a true story. I was in Kings Highway in Brooklyn.
Unbelievable. And real quickly, Andrew, a minute left. Can people read your credit cards with some kind of digital reader if they're next to you?
Some credit cards are being equipped with radio frequency chips. The same way that the passports are going to be issued.
Is that in that hologram that I see?
It's not a visual chip. It's actually an electronic radio frequency chip that when it gets a signal is broadcasted at it, it then rebounds on that signal your credit card or passport information to that sender. And so, yes, there are now documents out there, credit cards, passports, and so forth, that through radio frequency, you don't even have to have the wallet or the physical piece, you can gather that information. Now, it's supposed to be encrypted, but encryption, by its nature, wants to be unencrypted.
And can they wipe out all your credit cards? Can they erase that magnetic stripe? I don't know why they'd want to. But
well, there's magnetic pulses that could do that, but that's just malicious. And that type of crime isn't rampant.
Andrew, keep in touch with us. You are a wealth of information, my friend.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
His website, andrewkolarik.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com.